You ever wonder about the people in family photos or ever try to ask who these people really were? Every face is a narrow escape or a love story that almost didn't happen. Your family stories are hidden in plain view. You just haven't accessed it yet. There are versions of these rebels and dreamers before life told them who they needed to be. And I'm not talking about the shiny stories everyone knows. I'm talking about the soul-crushing experiences with heartbreaks and real loss. You gotta preserve these stories now. So contact thevietnamstorybank.com today. No polish, just raw, recorded, beautiful history that makes you sit up and hold your breath. We dig it all up, record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, unerased, untouchable, and unforgettable. Don't let silence have the last word. Go to vietnamstorybank.com today. Make sure your family's stories are recorded.
This podcast, I have Talia Tran here. She's an actress, among many other things. Today, we're going to talk a lot about your work inside of, really Hollywood now, you know, and we had you on a few years ago, and welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back. It's kind of crazy how the time has flown.
It's flown. You're like a full-blown adult now, right?
Well, it's kind of crazy to think about. Like when I started the show and everything, I was like a teen. I was, yeah. I think, if I remember correctly, like something like 16, 15, 16, somewhere in there. And yeah, I've really gotten to grow up with the cast. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's really special.
Yeah, I can imagine. You talked about Muay Thai. I want to get into that.
Yes, so bad. Yes,
yeah. You know, because years ago we talked about you being a musician,
yeah.
Piano, voice,
yeah.
Guitar. But Muay Thai is very different from any of that.
It's not. But it makes sense.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, like music ties in with dance, and dance, like I feel like these combat sports are a dance. You know what I mean? Whether it be the footwork or the rhythm or everything like that, I feel like musically, if you can tap into that, it really helps with everything. And I feel like I had a coach back in Vancouver when I was training up there. And I had another friend who was a dancer and musician. And whenever she would train, and she would be like, I'm not getting this. And then our coach would kind of translate it into musical terms or something like that for her to understand. And it really does it makes sense. There's so many connections in there.
Yeah. How did you get it? Why did you get into it?
Well, I had gotten into it because of my character, you know, like I really wanted to tap into the fighter side of her. And I think I love martial arts. You know, I came from a kung fu background, and I think there was something just a little different about the combat sports world, you know, when you're in it live and you're actually fighting, there's something that you feel when you're doing that. And I wanted to be able to feel that and capture that for myself, so that when I was doing my fight scenes and stuff like that I could really feel that. And I really do think it made a difference in terms of how much I was able to connect with my character.
For all you fans out there of Talia's, this is strange for me, because when I think about you, I just think about like the arts, like music and, you know, film and singing, right? But this is like a totally divergent path, and I'm trying to wrap my mind around it, you know. And look, I think it's a great thing. Do you ever want to compete as a fighter?
I've thought about it. I don't think I will compete as a fighter. I do feel like, again, fighting as something that I do for fun is very different from something that when you're competing, you know. Somebody else is kind of training to take your head off.
Right,
you know
what I mean? Do you train to take somebody's head off?
I mean, I'm not doing like any sort of fight camps or anything like that. But, you know, I do train, you know, as hard as I can.
You can, yeah.
And it's really fun. And I do think a lot of people don't expect it out of me. And I feel like this is something that when I have friends, like I encourage them to get into it, because I think there's a certain stereotype of what it means to be a combat sports person. I think there's a certain image of what it means to be like, a fighter. You know what I mean? And
how long have you been doing it?
I've been doing it for, gosh, like I would say a little over a year and a half in terms of just Muay Thai and boxing and stuff like that.
And has it changed your... I'm thinking of work, right?
Yeah.
The work
yeah,
that you do.
Yeah.
Has it changed your opportunity? Has it opened up more doors for you? Or has the actual job itself forced you to look into this so you could add more to your credentials?
I guess I haven't come across any roles in particular that require boxing or Muay Thai specifically.
Yeah.
But I will say I think it was very applicable to my job in Avatar. And I think, like, moving forward, I would love to do more stuff that's really active and in the martial arts / like combat sports space. I really enjoy that. And I mean, I feel like in terms of work application, I think generally it has improved my sense of confidence and you know, the sense of feeling empowered in your own self and in your own body. And I feel like that's something that's applicable all throughout life, but yeah, like very much in my
yeah, life. I see a total different shift. When I saw you today, I was like, yeah, oh, you're like, you're totally different.
Yeah, you know? I do feel like it has, I feel like it unlocks a part of you. You know what I mean? I think that it kind of, and people talk about what combat sports training kind of does to you as a person and in terms of developing who you are. And I think just really it strips you down. It strips down those layers. And when you're really in it, you are the rawest version of yourself.
Yeah.
And to get in touch with that, I think it really is really lovely. Yeah.
Are there other MMA sports that you're interested in? Like, do you watch UFC? Do you get into that?
I actually have. So I hadn't previously watched UFC. It really was like, oh, let me try fighting. Let me try fighting a little bit. And so, and then I got into it. And, you know, I remember when we would train and I would go out with some of the girls and we'd literally go watch UFC out wherever. And I remember this group of guys came up to our table. And they're like, what are you guys doing here? And we were like, what do you mean? They're like, you're not the typical viewer. Fan. And like, no, you know, we still belong in this space. You know what I mean? Even if we don't externally present as what you might expect of a UFC viewer or a combat sports fan. And one of my friends at the time, she was literally about to fight too. Like, wow. She was literally in a fight camp. And I was like, no, this is, we train, we still belong here. You know what I mean? Like, it's, I think seeing these spaces kind of expand and become more inclusive is really cool.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear. It's really, really cool. You know, I think when we were talking, you were still in high school, I believe, yeah. Right? Are you in college now? Are you?
I'm not. It was honestly really difficult just with the shooting schedule and stuff like that. Just I think I'm kind of figuring out that part of my life too, you know.
God, I'm so happy to hear this because now this is like, I mean, let's you know, both of your parents are doctors,
yes,
right?
Correct.
Both Vietnamese doctors.
Yes.
So, all right, that's like a whole thing.
Fun fact.
Oh my God! So let's unpack that. They're both Vietnamese doctors.
Correct.
They seem really cool. I've met them a few times. They're super open and cool. I mean, did they say no? Like, what's their thought on this?
You know, they never said no. I think that's one thing is, like, all along they've been supportive. And I know that there's a part of them that is, like, concerned to a degree. You know what I mean? Like, they want me to have a good future. And, you know, the way that they were raised is like, oh, you follow this path and you go to school and you get this specific degree and then you get the job at this hospital and then you live your life according to a certain path. And obviously I've way diverged from the path already.
I'm blown away right now.
And so
that they're cool with this.
And yeah, I mean, we've had conversations about it. It's like, oh, how bad do you want this? Is this a life you're willing to pursue and stuff like that. And I think we're still at the point where they're like, oh, you're young and you know, you have the space to roam and we can support you in doing so. And so I'm really grateful to have their continued support in that. But I know it was a little nerve-wracking, you know, when well, first of all, this was my first time living outside of the home by myself. When I went over to shoot in Vancouver again, because I was an adult shooting seasons 2 and 3, I moved out away from home, and so this was like a big jump for all of us, and they were kind of nervous. They're like, okay, like what's happening? You know, this is an adjustment. I'm also like the eldest child, like they haven't had experience in this particular thing before, and so they're like, you know what, just go for it. Just go for it.
I'm like itching and holding back from saying, Mom, Dad, I probably make more money than you.
No, love my mom and dad. Love my mom and dad. Love my mom and dad.
I'm like, it's itching to come out. I'm like,
They'd probably laugh at that one, though. They would support. They're like, you know what?
They're like, all right, we can't argue.
Maybe.
We can't argue with you there. Yeah. Like combined, I make more than you both combined. That is so hilarious. I mean, that would be for me the ultimate. I mean, as a Vietnamese person, like as a parent, I'm like, all right, I can't argue with you.
Yeah, that is true. I'm like, you know, like the checks come in, whatever, and then they're like, okay, this is like a
real thing.
This is a real thing, yeah. And I think that's also kind of so for the longest time. I think I had talked about this before, but we had hid my entire career from my grandparents for like the longest time. They didn't know I was an actress at all. I had been auditioning and stuff like that, and literally it took until a phone call came in while my grandma was in the car, and they're like, hey, you're flying out to Atlanta next week to film a movie. And then my parents were like, hey, so surprise, your granddaughter's an actress. So it was something, because already with my singing, even though I wasn't doing it professionally,
they were like,
no, please get less involved in this. You're going down a path, and we want you to, you know, stick to your studies and stuff like that. But there came a certain point in time when I think it was really when Council of Dads came out and they saw it on NBC and they were like, oh, wait, this is kind of real. They're like, this is a job. And they came to visit me when I was on set and they're like, oh, she's working. Like, this is actually a job, a career. Yeah. And they've really come around a lot. I think seeing something and seeing like the tangible, yeah, like
alcohol. The tangible bank account. Yeah. Sorry,
That's all. But I think that's something that I'm like really blessed to have, because
yeah,
I know a lot of people are in a certain part of their career where they're not being able to see the stuff like on mainstream television, yeah, and stuff like that. Because for them, it's like they can tell their friends, hey, tune into NBC at this, right, and this time, or hey, turn on your Netflix and look at this show, and their friends get it and they get it. But for other people who are in other parts of their acting journey or whatever, mm-hmm, maybe they're doing other stuff that's on other platforms, or they're doing indie films and stuff like that, where it's not as easily accessible,
yeah,
to,
yeah,
whoever. And it makes such a difference.
Yeah, huge difference. Huge difference. I think of the child acting part, and mm-hmm, I think about when you have the success early in your life and to continue it like a DiCaprio, right? Where he can once a year make a big movie and, yeah, contain his ability to, I don't know, party and lose his mind like a lot of child actors. Do you think about that at all?
It's very interesting. So I guess like when I talk with other child actors, like there's different degrees to which we are child actors.
Yeah, yeah.
I started, oh gosh.
Not like 7 or 8.
No. Yeah. I was 11, 12, maybe somewhere in there. And I think that did make a difference, because I have such strong memories of before I was an actor and when I was like a normal child. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Not involved in any like work stuff. Because at the end of the day, it is a job. You go to work, and for a 12-year-old to be working like this,
yeah,
is not typical.
Right.
It's not a bad thing. It's just not typical. And so I think there was a strong point in my life in which my experiences began to diverge from the typical,
yeah,
youth path. And I think having a before really grounded me, in my personal opinion, because it's like I knew I got to experience life when it wasn't career-driven. And I don't think it's a bad thing to be career driven, right, but right. I think there is something to be said for life when you're just living it for yourself and just to have fun and just to, you know, just to be a kid. And I'm grateful I got to have that experience while still, you know, enjoying stuff like music and stuff like that and doing stuff that I was really passionate about, but with no professional focus on it. But I have talked to other child actors who started really, really, yeah, really young, and they hopped into homeschool really early. And so I think, you know, you miss out on certain, yeah, experiences. Yeah. And it really is a sacrifice, because, again, just practically speaking, when you start earlier like that, it is a great advantage.
Oh, really?
Well, I'm talking to everybody, because the pool is going to be smaller. When you start young like that, it's like you're competing against fewer people for any given role. So just just statistically, the likelihood is higher because there's still going to be roles for young kids, but they're just going to be fewer people competing for them. And so that is, I understand why people or why parents would want to their kids to enter the industry early. Because if you know that you want to be in this industry and you're going to wait until you're older, which is not to say that it's impossible, but if you're waiting until you're older, it gets very competitive. By that time, people have training. By that time, people have been building their skills for years and years and years. And where are you at? You know what I mean? If you can get to like a teen and already have a resume on you, that looks so good.
Yeah, yeah.
That looks so good when you walk into an audition room.
But I think mental health-wise, how does that play out for your long-term future?
I feel like it does take a
toll on it, right?
And for me, I'm really grateful I didn't start at that early age.
So 11 and 12 is the kind of...
Well, I guess, again, I'm biased from my own experiences because I was able to have a normal childhood. Yeah. And even starting later, I'm still able to continue to work. And there are people who started later who weren't able to get a chance to work. You know what I mean? And I'm sure for those people, they're like, oh man, I regret and I wish I could have started earlier. So I think it's just always, it's very individual. It's very much also, I think we need to center what the child feels. You know what I mean? Like at that time, I felt like I wanted to do it. I was ready. My parents had never pushed me into any of this. This is all like 100% I wanted to do this. And I think that's what makes a difference. I remember there was a point in time when I was like studying music and stuff like that. And I was like, I want to quit music. I want to quit piano. I'm just tired. And I had talked to my parents about it. And at that time I was very young and they said, okay, you can quit. But if you want to, if you really love music, you can take a break from it or whatever. But if you love music and you think that's something that you want to continue doing, please consider the fact that continuing to do it right now will help you in the future. And they said, but we are okay with whatever decision you make. And I remember this so vividly because I thought about it and I'm like, I really do love music and I love singing and this is such an asset to me. And so I decided to continue forward. And I think that that decision that they gave me is so fundamental to my continued enjoyment of what I do and to my ability to enjoy my mental health while I continue to do this. Because every step of the way, I felt like I've had my own autonomy. I think when I talk with people who really struggle with their mental health in being a child actor, there's a certain point in time in which they feel like they lose the sense of autonomy. And I think that that is really like a driving force in what makes them feel like you need to act out in a certain way or you're craving something, you're craving a certain type of freedom because you feel locked into a career that maybe somebody else is like feeling pressure to keep you in. And the other thing is, I remember meeting some actors who were very, very young and their parents depended on them financially. Oh, and that's a really, really
big problem.
That's a big, yeah. Because even if they wanted to quit, imagine holding that burden of being, I support my family. Mm. Imagine being 13 years old and being like, I support my family.
So that's the advantage that you have.
Yes, yeah. both of my parents continued with working. And so I never felt...
pressure.
That pressure. And I feel like at the end of the day, mindset is really such a...
huge thing.
For anything that you do.
Huge.
I think like when it comes to like setting goals, no matter what it be, if the goal is something that you're really stressed about and that you feel like, oh, if it becomes something that you feel unworthy if you cannot complete this goal.
The pressure builds.
And it really just takes such a toll on you. And I think in the end, it's harder to complete that goal when it becomes a burden to you and it's weighing you down. And I think when you can approach it with, you're looking for like fun and enjoyment and self-fulfillment, I think that it's just so much easier to accomplish goals with a healthy mindset.
No, that's such a good point. And that's why I think today mental health is so, it's pushed so much. And then, you know, previous generations are like, oh, you're so weak, you know, but it's different now. It's the idea of like giving it your best and giving it the best product because our mental health is like really strong is a thing.
Yeah. I still do see it with like, whether it be my parents or other people from older generations, just a little bit of a disconnect in terms of like, it's great to hear you being very accepting of, like, what it, like, the seriousness of mental health issues. And I think my parents also do understand, but also I think just in the younger generation, there's, like, a fundamental understanding of it, like, where we grew up with this understanding, whereas in my parents, I think it was a developed understanding. And in some people of their generation, it's like they don't even understand yet. Like, they...
It's a different language.
And I'm like, how do you explain this to somebody who fundamentally doesn't believe in it and who doesn't recognize it in themselves either? Because I feel like that with a lot of these people who deny mental health issues, a lot of times they struggle with their own mental health issues. And because they can't reckon with it within themselves, they deny it within everybody else.
All right, I'm going to break out with an analogy.
Yes.
It's very simple to me. Let's just say that at your stage of understanding mental health, let's just say you have a 50,000 word vocabulary for, that's a high number. Let's just say 5,000, right? Yeah. Let's just say 5,000. Well, 50,000 makes more sense. But let's just say as your mental health awareness, you have 50,000 ways to explain and tell people about. And then when you're talking about, like, the previous generation, they're only down to 2,000 words, right?
Yes.
So if you can only understand and appreciate these thoughts at 2,000 words and somebody's at 50,000, then there is no way that they're going to be able to look at you and go, I don't understand why you have all these weird thoughts.
Yeah.
Because you have 50,000, you have 48,000 more ways to, like, understand how you feel. And your parents and me were in the same generation. I'm probably at 40,000 and climbing up to 50,000. But we had to learn from our parents at 2,000. And we're like at, you know, we started out at 10,000. And then, like, in the last 10 years, we climbed up to 40,000. So we're beginning to understand it, you know. And coming from, like, for me, a military Marine background, I was like, I don't need any of those 40,000 words. I just need to understand 5,000 words because I need to get the job done. And that's...
Yeah.
So that's where the disconnect is really happening. But now that I'm looking at my children, they're 7 and 9, I can see that if I don't adapt to the 50,000 words by the time they're going to... At your age, they're probably going to be at 80,000. They're going to be so sensitive to everything, which is... I can't... Stop that.
No.
I have to grow with that. And that's the key thing, I think.
That's such a great mentality to have, though, like wanting to continue to connect with your kids on that level. Because I think that's where I see a lot of divisions. Or some of my friends, you know, they realize at a certain point they can't talk to their parents about certain things, you know. And it's really sad because there's obviously so much love there. But again, that vocabulary. It doesn't match. And if there isn't that desire to learn and grow, it stays stagnant. And what makes me curious is, like, how can you instill that desire in somebody else? You know what I mean? Like, how can you motivate somebody to want to expand their vocabulary in that way? That's a great
question. I do it with my mom. So when she feels like I'm attacking her, I have to sit her down. I have to really slow time down. And this is what I say. My mom's 76. And then so... She probably has, I don't know, let's just say she's at the 5,000, 10,000 level and I'm at the 40,000. I have to sit down and tell my mom this. I say, Mom, I need to talk to you because I love you dearly and I want to get closer to you. And that's hard to say from anybody, right?
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to say to your mother my mom and I are at a very different level than somebody like your age or my kids. So having the courage to tell my mother that calms her nervous system down. She doesn't feel attacked.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned. So whenever, like, you're like, you take the baseball bat out on your parents, like, well, I used to do that. And I, you know, sometimes I fall into that mindset of doing that to my mom or bringing out this, like, gun that she sees in my hand and my mouth. She sees, like, the bullets are going to fly soon. It freezes them up and makes them want to cry and break and defensive. And then, but what if I say, look, I want to protect you and I want you to be loved. So what I'm going to say is here to help our relationship. And that's hard to do. It drains me to do that. But that's the way to do it, I think. To make them feel secure and to make them feel not attacked. and loved is the hardest thing to do.
That makes sense. And I feel like that also requires a great amount of self-awareness to recognize, like, I'm sure there are times when I'm trying to communicate with somebody and I'm being more, like, I'm coming at them more than I think I'm coming at them. Because I probably think I'm, like, just speaking facts or something like that. And maybe I'm not phrasing that in a way that's beneficial to the listener. And I think that's another thing, like, the way that you say things and the way that you mean things is so different from how it's received. And like that's what people say, like, impact over intention, right? And it really is really true.
It's 100% true. Yeah. That's like the new thing, right? And then like the last maybe 5 years, impact is so much more important than intention. It is everything. It's like, I don't care what you intended. I don't even care what you're saying, but how I'm feeling, even if you don't say anything, is how I'm feeling.
Exactly. And it's hard to change that until you really change the way that you speak with another person. Like, if they continue coming at you this way and they're like, well, I'm continuing to intend it this way. And I'm like, well, I'm continuing to feel this way.
Yeah.
It's never gonna.
But I think what, to get even meta about this is like, if two people are talking and like mom and dad and me, if I'm talking to them, my biggest concern as a human being, just naturally programmed, is like, you don't understand a word I'm saying. Mm. And even if you did understand, you're not going to change your stance.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem that we have, that the other person, we are afraid that they are not listening with an open mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like that's also what makes it so scary to be vulnerable. Because, like, imagine opening yourself up to somebody and then just shutting it down.
Yeah.
And then being like, oh, that's not worth my time. You know what I mean? I think I've had some conversations like this, and it's like, you're like, this is how I feel. And it really sucks for somebody to be so dismissive. And they're like, well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And then from there, like, you don't really want to share how you feel anymore. You don't really want to share, like this can come from a place of love, and you're showing love in this way, and they're kind of shutting it down. They're like, oh, well, your love doesn't matter in this way.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really sucky feeling.
My mom's common reply to me is, you're so complicated. And that's ever since I was like a kid. You're so complicated. And it's true. Because if I have 40,000 vocabulary words about this and you only have 8,000, then of course I'm going to be like 4 or 5 times more complicated than you are. And I'm running circles around your ability to do logic on me, right? But I have to like calibrate myself and say, look, this, and tell myself, look, this is not about winning this argument with my mother.
Mm.
But that's hard to do because you're like, you know, my blood sugars have like gone through the roof when I'm like arguing with them.
Yeah.
And so that's hard. I think we're just living in a day and age where it's not that we're softer or weaker than the previous generation. We just demand more language.
Yeah, more nuance to everything.
More nuance to everything.
And I want to say about the thing about being complicated. I don't think it's an innately bad thing to be complicated. I think humans are complex creatures. And when there's a disconnect between the complexity of your vocabulary and the complexity of your experience, it can come across as, oh, well, I'm just simpler, better, whatever, like more compact. But really, there's just a disconnect there. And it's, I think, the level of disservice to yourself that is lost upon many people. And so when you can get a complex vocabulary to match the complexity of your experience, it actually adds a lot of color to your life experiences. And it adds a level of depth and nuance to everything, that your relationships with people, your relationships with yourself. And I think that until somebody experiences that for themselves, they may not understand how beneficial that is.
Tale, you know what a trippy thought, like this conversation, it is really trippy. If you think about how many Vietnamese parents and their kids are not talking, or they're in the room and they're like, Easter or some whatever Mother's Day brunch. Yeah. They're talking, but they're not really talking.
Yeah.
So I would even say it's 70% to 80% of parents to kids. It's like, everybody's like talking, everybody's enjoying, but they're not really understanding each other.
Yeah. I remember there's one conversation I had with my dad that stuck with me a long time. And it was like, he was like, if you're not getting into arguments of some sort or conflict with the people that you love, that you're not in deep enough with them.
Wow.
Because he was saying it's easy to keep things surface level and agreeable. And he said that that's not true vulnerability. That's not true like intimacy between people, until you can open up and show like show your wounds and show these things. And when you can both be open about that, and that opens up an uncomfortable conversation, and it's going to come across as, oh, this isn't working out, this is uncomfortable. But when you work through that, it gets so much better. And that's what true conversation is. I think you're so right. Even you can be in the same room and you can just be chatting on such a surface level, and it feels like, oh, well, we're talking, we're there. But it is all just so superficial until you can get into that level of like vulnerability and complexity with another person.
Your parents have been here for a long time. Do you feel like they are growing in that direction where they're trying to improve their communication?
I definitely do agree. I remember my dad, I think he studied like sociology or something like that in school. And I think he was saying that that was like a fundamental experience for him in terms of growing in that direction, like an understanding people and just being more open-minded to things. And I think when I was little, me and my mom, like the conversations that we would have are very different from the conversations we have now. I can see so much growth in terms of how we communicate and her openness to changing certain language and to just like changing on both ends. You know what I mean? I don't want it to ever be just like, yeah, oh, I need you to change in this way, mm-hmm, and I need you to grow explicitly, and I'm just going to sit here and watch you grow. I think it's a shared growth, and I think that my dad's presence has really facilitated that for the both of us, because he's very much like a mediator type of person,
yeah,
and he's very even keeled, and he kind of helps us kind of grow through everything together.
You have worked outside of just TV. You've done film, right? Do you feel like there's a difference in the language of the two?
I feel like, well, in my experience of TV and film, just the main thing that really sticks out to me is the pace of it. And I was noticing with TV, because there are so many different people that come in, we have new directors for like every other episode, like a new director comes, mm-hmm, in, and this, when there are so many brains involved and it's just so complicated, the more people are involved and the more fast paced everything is, it's like sometimes things get lost in translation, or sometimes it's like everybody has to give up something. I think with film, it was less of, it was more like individual to that director. You know what I mean? And I think both are a really cool experience as an actor, to get to see the artistic vision of a director in a film come to life in a very them way. You know what I mean? And in a way that's kind of very, obviously there's input from the producers and from the studio and everything like that, but it's a lot less filtered than with TV, where it's filtered through everybody at every level on every episode, every day. It's a different experience for sure, but I think it's good to have both.
Will you ever jump in the game for producing, directing behind the camera?
I should say that I got to shadow when I was on Avatar, which was really, really cool.
Shadowed the director?
Yeah, I shadowed our director like through some of her like when she was preparing for it, and then during the shoot, and then I've shadowed another one of our directors who's also one of our showrunners.
So you had to ask?
I did. I asked about it because I was very curious. It's with such, especially with such a large scale show.
Yeah,
it's crazy the amount of things that they have to juggle, and I feel like the actor's experience is just so, it's kind of isolated from the rest of what everyone else, mm-hmm, is experiencing, and I feel like it really opened up my eyes a lot. Season one, I remember we came in, and obviously it was a pretty minimal presence in season one, but we were very much shielded from a lot of the things that were happening on set. And that was an intentional decision by our showrunner. I had a conversation with him about it later, but he wants to shield the actors from a lot of the problems,
yeah,
on set. And after that conversation, I was like, but I'm curious, what are these problems? Like, what is happening here? And so season two, season three, I got to shadow and I was like, oh, it's at the end of the day, it's really just all these people who really care about the show, right? They really want to make it the best, but they have different ideas about how to go about it. And in the directing role, they have to be able to bridge the gaps between this and be like, okay, this is a good idea. This is a good idea. Let's combine this in this way. And we can make something that everybody feels like confident about. So I think communication is like the ultimate skill of the director. Yeah. You know, you think about it, oh, they can make it look a certain way. They can make it whatever. But I think at the end of the day, what is so like most important for a director is their ability to communicate with people.
So will you ever be open to doing it?
I would love to. I think I'm still very early in my journey, yeah. obviously, and I have so much to learn in that world because it's so much. Like
it's a lot.
It's like I would go from meeting to meeting with them and I was like, oh my goodness, like the amount that they have to juggle and all these decisions that they have to make and the level of detail that they have to get into everything. And especially with our show where they were working on seasons two and season three at the same time, they were working on all these episodes all at once. We were block shooting and they were just jumping from set to set. And it was like, oh my goodness, yeah. How do you mentally just keep this straight and
all going?
Yeah. All at the same time. And I asked Jabbar, like he was a showrunner and director. And I was like, how did you learn how to do this? And I love asking people this question, especially when it comes to jobs that are not very straightforward.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, there's no textbook on this.
No.
You can't follow a 1-2-3 step and like you know how to do this. This is just so outside of the box. How do you even begin to conceptualize what you have to learn in order to be a director? And then how do you learn those skills? Like where do you get this from? And he was just like, you know, I just did what you did. You know, I just started shadowing with people. I just started interning. And you just begin to internalize things. And I'm like, I think, at least for me, like I underestimate my ability to internalize these abstract concepts. But I think everybody can, you know. I think a lot of what it comes from and again, with Asian communities being very resistant to artistic and creative, it's like it's so outside of a track. We want structure. We want a roadmap. And I think we just underestimate our ability to be able to adapt to these abstract things and these things that don't have a fixed box, you know? We can juggle a lot more than we think.
It starts with this previous generation instilling this belief in us as a second, third generation Vietnamese. I was in a meeting yesterday and I'm, you know, getting more involved with podcast hosting in Vietnamese language. And there was a person that was sitting across the table from me, my future host. And we were talking about the idea of being authentic to speak about these topics. And he said, who am I? And I'm like, he was like some, you know, much 10 years older than me. And he's like, who am I? I have no authority. Who am I to like speak up on the topics that we're going to, I'll just stay as a host.
Yeah.
And I said to him, you are the reason why most of us hit the ceiling because we don't believe that we are capable or we don't have the voice to say what we want in the workplace.
Yeah.
It's parents like you. So this is why it's so important for you to become not a host, but a personality on a podcast show with me so that we can talk about this and open this idea of communication up. Because otherwise, we're just going to always be stunted and be in the medical profession. No hate on the medical profession. It's just that we can affect a lot of change by being on the outside and being vocal and believing we can do it.
Yeah, it really is like we need to believe in ourselves more, like just all around. And I think this idea of worthy of things, whether you deserve things, like it's very interesting. I think just generally we tend to perceive it as like you do this and this and this and you're worthy of this, and it's very transactional. It's very like I like to believe that we're inherent with a certain type of worth, and our experience is worth more than we know, more than we recognize. And, you know, I think we all are on our own journeys of finding that, and it's like a lifelong journey. You know what I mean? It's not like you wake up one day and you're like, yeah, I'm worthy. It's like, it really is. You work on it, and I think it fluctuates too. Like, there'll be days when you're like, I don't really know what I'm doing.
Do you have those days?
Yeah.
Do you?
I remember, like, when I went to shoot Council, and I was like, it was the beginning of shooting, and I was like, what am I doing? Like, I don't deserve to be here. And I think it's that imposter syndrome that, you know.
At your stage?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think because there's like, I think it's just difficult to conceptualize. You make such a grand idea of this goal that you have, right? And you put it on this pedestal, and then you achieve that goal. And I don't put myself on that pedestal. And there's this big gap, right? And so I just can't reckon with that gap. I'm like, what am I doing here? This was this huge dream of mine. And here I am, like, living this huge dream of mine. Who am I to be doing that? And I think there just became so many questions about, like, for example, what about these other people that I think are so worthy and aren't doing the show? It becomes all these questions about what do I deserve and what am I doing here? But I think what really helped me was, like, at this point, I think, you know, we're all worthy of doing stuff that brings us fulfillment. And the fact that I get to do it, I need to focus on my gratitude. I need to focus on making the most out of this opportunity to not only, like, help myself, but also use this to help others too.
Yeah.
Like, this is a great opportunity, and why should I waste it on being so fixated on myself? You know what I mean? At the end of the day, when I'm thinking about all this stuff, I'm like, oh, this is just at the end of the day, just I'm so focused on inside. I'm like, what can I do to expand this experience instead of just minimizing myself?
Where do you see yourself in terms of the work that you do, both acting or behind the cameras, in a few years? Do you contemplate that? Is there like a path that you've plotted or charted for yourself?
I think I have general ideas of, like, I would love to continue expanding the type of work that I do. And by that, I mean just, like, I've gotten to dabble in many different genres and many different types of roles, and I would like to continue expanding upon that and getting to experience lots of different experiences and get to live different lives through my characters and maybe even get to diverge into more of the behind the camera work and all that stuff and just get to overall broaden my horizons. But I think when it comes to plotting out specific things, and, you know, there's a very popular concept of vision boarding now, right?
Yeah.
And I've thought about it, and I've had some experiences with it, but I don't like attaching myself to very specific ideas of things that I want. I this is my own personal philosophy on it, but I feel like, for example, if I say I want role A and I must get role A, and on the surface I'm like, well, this is great motivation for me to get role A, but then what if I don't get it? And that's very, very crushing to me. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh my god, I have to, like, do all this mental work about, like, what it means for me to not get that. I'm like, I don't want to get myself super attached to a very specific idea of what I want, because why do I want this? What do I want out of this specific experience? I wanted this role because I wanted to be able to play this set of character traits. I wanted this role because it would open these specific doors for me. I wanted this role because I wanted this specific type of experience. I'm like, okay, so if I can generalize that and figure out what I fundamentally want, I can set not only more attainable goals for myself, but just bring myself more fulfillment through that. Because if I narrow my vision like that, what if I get a role that is fulfilling for me in that same way, but I just don't recognize it because it doesn't match with what I had written on my vision.
How did you figure that out?
I think it was a lot of looking back on my journey and looking back on the way that I've learned to deal with rejection. Because I've come to a place where I'm quite good at dealing with the rejections from everything. Because as an actor, you have to be able to deal with rejections. And I realized this is applicable to many points in my life. There's so many things I'm less scared of because I've gotten the chance to deal with all these rejections through acting. And I'm like, so what has changed my mindset to allow me to grow in this way? And I was like, I don't get very attached to specific things. I latch onto the idea of I'm chasing a certain type of of fulfillment for myself. And I'm like, so where can I find that fulfillment? And so in the end of the day, you're looking to find this fulfillment in multiple places. And the more that you look for it, the more you're going to find it. If you're only looking for one specific thing, it's going to be hard to find. It's finding like a needle in a haystack. But if you're looking for like, oh, this type of thing, just open your mind to ideas of like, these are all the things that could bring me fulfillment. I don't have to be attached to any specific idea. So I think it's a lot of reworking like what has happened until now and kind of doing self-evaluations. I'm like, what has changed in my mindset? What has worked for me? What has not worked for me? What has brought me joy? And that's kind of how I think my mindset has like shifted towards like, okay, this brought me joy. Let me continue on that. Let me just continue. And it's just like, yeah, I feel like I don't journal a lot, but I like to go on walks and stuff like that. And I'll just turn on music and I'll just think. And it's really nice to just sit alone with your own thoughts and your own experiences. And the more that you reflect upon your experiences over and over again, I feel like the more that you get out of it. And I know there's this, when you're with your, I don't know, maybe this is just a me thing, but like when I'm with my best friends, you know, oftentimes we can talk about the same thing over and over and over again, but we can still find things to get out of it. And I'm like, oh, this same idea can be applied to myself. I can think about the same things over and over again, and there's still more to get out of it.
And ladies and gentlemen, I learned a lot. I just picked up 10,000 new vocabulary words that we talk about in this very paradigm that we're talking. It's such a shifting. It's like, don't worry about the destination as much as the things that you're kind of like picking up on the peripheral of that journey to the destination.
Yeah.
And getting that fulfillment on an abstract level is much more profound, and it's much more there's more of a completion there that butchering this, but
no 100%. I think that's such a great way to like visualize it, because like it's shifting that mindset from a very concrete thing of like 1 + 2 = 3, and being like, oh, these are all the things around it, and these are all the things that I can enjoy, so why not enjoy them?
Yeah. And I think that is why the Muay Thai experience, why shadowing a director and all of it, you know, as Steve Jobs said, when you look back on all the points, you'll see the connection. Mm-hmm. But you can't see the connection of the points going forward. And I think that that's a fallacy of like putting the destination as the main goal. It shouldn't be at all. And I'm really experiencing that in the podcast now, because there is no end game to this.
No.
Yeah. But just sitting here to talk about this today is one of the things that have, I'm going to be thinking about this for the next week, right?
Yeah, me too. It's really lovely. Like, I think we are so fixated on like putting things into a map and getting to a very specific destination. Yeah. And I'm like, it's not always about that. It's about enjoying stuff like this. Like, this is so life-affirming, and it really opens your brain. Like, after this, I feel like I'm going to walk away and I'm going to enjoy so many more things just because I'm like, oh, this shifted my mindset on this particular thing. And I had a conversation with somebody about a thing about being creative, and being creative doesn't always have to serve a purpose, as in, you don't have to create music with the intent of, I'm going to release this in 2 months. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the next big hit. It's going to whatever. Like, creativity to serve the purpose of self-expression, to serve for the pure purpose of creativity, is beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's so fulfilling. I think in a society where we're like, everything has to be sold for this, whatever. And you place such a value on like transactional things like that. It's like, to create is great.
Before we end tonight or today, I want to shout out my friend Jess Vu for putting this together. Thank you, Jess.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And where can we find Avatar?
Avatar, the last Airbender will be on Netflix in June. June 25th,
June 25th. So this is season 2. And then are they going to wait for another year for season 3 to come out? Or is it back to back?
No idea when season 3 is going to come out. So that's going to be a surprise to me.
Okay.
Too. But I know I've been seeing them work on the stuff. I think it's just a matter of the timing and when they would like for it to drop.
Yeah. You are an inspiration to me, and you are an inspiration to the likes of my children, because they mentioned that and they're like, oh, look, Talia. This is going to be an amazing thing to see come June. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.